Hello and welcome to the Literati Cast. I'm Jennifer Loughran and I'm a senior agent at the Andrea Brown Literary Agency, where I rep kids' books from picture books through YA and everything in between. Today's episode is very special because it was recorded live at an event for Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck, New York, my town bookstore. For the past 10 years, the bookstore owner Susanna and myself have been running a semi-monthly event series at Oblong called the Hudson Valley YA Society. The events are great fun and have always been popular. We've hosted almost 200 authors over the years. But since the shutdown, obviously, all events were canceled. So this is the very first Oblong online version of the Hudson Valley YA Society, and it's also our 10th anniversary party, as well as a launch party for one of our local authors, Christine Hepperman. When I realized that we were going to be recording this event via Zoom, I also realized that I might be able to actually share it with my podcast listeners as well. I will say, as a caveat, please remember that this was not originally intended to be a broadcast. It is a live event recorded the evening of Sunday, August 16th, 2020, with authors all over the country. That includes in Los Angeles, where there was a record heat wave and blackouts and brownouts that may have caused some glitchiness with the sound quality. And, you know, Zoom itself is not quite as nice as a regular recording. There are four authors and one me, which is a lot of people talking. So it's different from the regular podcast. But it's also such a unique chance to hear four brilliant authors. I didn't want people who couldn't be there live to miss it. I really hope you enjoyed listening in on my panel with Christine Hepperman, Cherie L. Smith, Brandy Colbert, and Laura Ruby, live from our Oblong online event. And here we go. This, for those of you who do not know, is the Hudson Valley YA Society, and it is our 10th anniversary party. Yes, it has been 10 years since I moved here from San Francisco, and we started this event series with Susanna Hermans, who is somewhere. There she is. Hi. Our very first authors were Natalie Standiford, Cecil Castellucci, and Siobhan Vivian. In the past 10 years, we have hosted more than 180 amazing YA authors, bestsellers, award winners, fan favorites, debuts who went on to become fan favorites. And it's been such a joy to bring so many stellar YA voices to our community. And we've also watched our original teen members grow up, go to college, graduate from college, come back as adults, in some cases start to work at the bookstore. And we also welcomed whole new cohorts of kids who love YA books, along with, of course, our beloved grown-up audience members, many of whom are authors, artists, teachers, librarians, and book professionals in their own right. I know that I speak for Susanna and Nicole and everyone else at Oblong when I say thank you guys for all the support you've shown us over the past 10 years. We love you, and we're hoping to bring you many more great young adult events in the coming months, years, virtually and in person, and however else we can do it. Anyway, that's enough housekeeping. We've got so much to talk about. Today, we're super excited to celebrate, along with our 10th anniversary, the launch party for Christine Hepperman's brilliant, glorious new novel in verse. It actually comes out on Tuesday, and you can get a signed copy through Oblong. It is called What Goes Up? But also, she brought her friends along to help celebrate. Friends like Brandy Colbert, whose latest book is the extremely timely YA, The Voting Booth. Cherie L. Smith, whose beautiful historical book, The Blossom and the Firefly, is set in the 40s in Japan. And Laura Ruby, 13 Doorways, Wolves Behind Them All, came out some months ago, but it is a beloved fan favorite of Oblong. And quite ghostly. And I know that we'll have lots to talk about. So let's get into it. Could you each introduce yourself and just give us a little nutshell elevator pitch about what your book's about?
I guess I should go first.
Yes.
So first I want to say, though, too, the Hudson Valley YA Society has been really important to me and been really important to my family. We moved to the Hudson Valley from Chicago 7 years ago this week, I think, and just finding out that Oblong Books was there and that Jen, a celebrity, worked there in the children's book field, and that she had this amazing, you know, there was this amazing lecture series. We've gone to, you know, so many of the panels, and it's probably a good thing that it's not in the store today, because somebody from my family always wins the raffle that Jen does. So we usually clean up on all those items she raffles off. So just thank you, Jen, and everyone in Oblong for providing such an awesome venue for YA authors and for people who are interested in YA books. My book, What Goes Up, it's been a long journey getting here. It was one of those things where when I finished my last novel in verse, asked me how I got here, and this was like the second book of a two-book contract, and I had a couple ideas, and I'm like, oh, you know, I could probably, like, you know, one of these will work and I can get it out there in a year or so. And then a year and a half later, when I'm crying to Tita, my agent, and Martha, my editor, it's like, it's just not going anywhere. For one of the, I guess one way that I like to talk about this book is, you know, that quote, I think it's from Mark Twain, that's like, I'm sorry I wrote this long letter. I didn't have time to write it shorter. Like, I wrote this long, like, my book, it was called, the work in progress was called Train Car, because there was an old abandoned train car that I used to pass all the time in a field, and I would think, who could be living in there? And, like, now there's no train car at all in the book. It had demonic possession, it had, like, heroin addiction, there was so much stuff shoved into this book. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger and, like, spinning out of control. And I finally had to realize, you know what? I really, the heart of it is, like, this little story. So from this big thing to paring it down to basically it's about, like, the courage to get out of bed in the morning. It takes place within, you know, I know Brandy's book takes place within a day, and my book takes place within a couple hours. And it seems like a timely thing for this pandemic, I think, like, the courage to get up and, like, face some of your mistakes, face something that you're angry about. My main character, Jory, is, wakes up in a strange loft bed, not quite sure what she did the night before, and the guy she was with is sleeping on the floor, and she's got to decide if she's going to sneak down and, like, walk past him and get out. And she's lying there thinking, you know, I could just stay up here all day. So it went from this kind of big behemoth to this small, you know, when you're writing, you, like, don't know what the heart of the story is. And it took me a while to figure out the heart of the story. And once I did, it was, like, off and running, but it took me, like, 4 years to get off and running. So sometimes it happens.
Okay. Laura, in a nutshell, Christine, by the way, but fair enough.
She hasn't had time to work at the nutshell yet.
Yeah, I'll do my elevator pitch, you know, some other time.
My latest is 13 Doorways, Wolves Behind Them All. And this is a YA about two girls. One living, her name is Frankie. She is just trying to survive life in a Chicago orphanage during the Depression and World War II. And one dead, our narrator Pearl, who tells us about Frankie's life as she figures out and puts together the pieces of her own life that ended during World War I.
That was a nutshell.
That was a nutshell.
Well done.
Sheree?
Next.
Okay. I don't know. I'm so used to going in alphabetical order, I'm usually last.
Oh, no, I was just randomly.
The Blossom and the Firefly is set during World War II in Japan. And by the end of the war, the kamikaze pilot program became an official program towards the end of 1944. And by the spring of 45, the pilots were as young as 17. So this is the story of a 17-year-old boy pilot named Taro, who, if he was not a pilot, he would be a violinist. And a girl named Hana, who in this small town in southern Japan, junior high school girls were mobilized to act as maids for the kamikaze pilots in their final days before their last mission. And their last job was to line the runway and wave goodbye. So this is a story set in 8 days is about the two of them meeting and sort of asking the question, is that enough time to have a love? Sorry, Dan, but it's actually not a story.
Brandy, nutshell?
Yeah, sure, nutshell. This is, like Christine said, is the voting booth. It's set in all in one day. It's about two first-time teen voters who meet at the polls. Marva is our heroine, and she is very passionate about voting. She's been waiting for this day her whole life. Duke is our hero, and he's sort of not feeling the same way. He's voting more out of obligation to his family and his late activist brother. And so they meet at the polls on election day. Marva sees Duke getting turned away. She completely inserts herself into his life. And they take off on a whirlwind of a day, getting to know each other and trying to get his vote in.
Awesome. So these books are all very different, obviously. But something that they have in common, I think, is how they play with narrative in unusual ways, perhaps. So, Christine, your book is contemporary realistic, but it's also told in verse. And time is consolidated in a really unusual way. It's like both the few minutes or couple of hours between waking up and going home. And then, but it's also bopping back and forth in time because as our heroine is piecing together her story, Brandy, voting booth is also contemporary realistic, but it's got two dueling POVs. And again, it's a very short window of time. It's like from when the polls open to when they close. We don't even know who wins. Cherie, Blossom the Firefly is this historical, but it's also told in two POVs, and one of them is always kind of in the present day in 1945, and one of them we see a sweeping, you know, longer life story from the 30s, and how he came to be in the present in 1945. And then Laura, yours is also historical, spans multiple time frames, plays with memory, has a POV character who's a ghost and can see things that nobody else can see, as well as having their own story. There's a question buried in here, which is, which comes first, the voice, the plot, or the structure? In other words, like, did you know from the beginning that you wanted it to be, say, a he said, she said narrative, or be set all in the span of a day, or told from a ghost POV, or did that come after messing around with the plot and the concept?
It came after for me. I mean, originally I was trying to write something in prose. I was trying to get away from verse because I'd been doing that in my last few books. I had a character who was possessed by a demon, and I was going to try to do like two POVs in one. That was like my interesting thing that I was trying to do. Safe, spoiler alert, it did not work. So I think, you know, for me, it all comes down to character, like trying to figure out who this character is and what she is most, you know, what her passions are, what her emotions are. And so I think I had to figure out who she was. And then once I got her voice, then kind of the structure of it came from that. But I couldn't really get the whole structure down. I tried so many different things that just were kind of going around in a circle. And finally, when I figured out who she was, then that voice kind of came out the way it did.
For me, it was definitely the plot, like, had to be centered around voting day. I didn't want, like you said, Jen, like, I don't even know who wins. I don't know who was in the election in this book. I don't know if it was, you know, our real world or if it was a fictional world. So I knew it was going to have to be just kind of drilled down to like 12 or I think it's like a 12-hour day. But like Christine said, for me, it's really character sort of dictates most of the book. My books are not super plot heavy. This is probably like my plottiest book ever. So I think kind of having those rules was really helpful, but I also liked being able to kind of drill down the characters and make them a big part, because really the whole book has been just sort of driving around with this one goal in mind, like fighting these obstacles, but you're really getting to know them and their lives and like why this day is so important to each of them on different levels.
I would say for me that I always knew it was going to be two points of view because their lives were so different, you know, like a 15-year-old schoolgirl who spends her days doing laundry and making beds and serving food, and a pilot. And I'm very interested in World War II aviation. I keep going back to it. So I wanted to be able to show his entire lifetime to understand, like, how do you get to this point where you're willing to sacrifice yourself for your nation? And then for her story, I was very interested in what does it do to someone to constantly send people to their deaths? You know, when you're so young and have no support system for it because everybody's suffering, and just sort of the bigger question of, like, you know, what happens to young people in war? So it was really, the struggle was finding her voice, because I knew for him, like, oh, there's all this, like, technical stuff I can dig into and flying and the history of that and blah, blah, blah. But for her, just, like, finding a voice that felt true. So she changed the most. But it wasn't until I got her voice down that I could write the book.
Normally, when I write, well, writing every book demands a different thing. Every book demands a different thing. But usually I have to find the sound or the voice of the book in order to write it. So you have the voices of the characters or whatever. And sometimes it's very close if you have like a first person, but narration, but there's every book has a particular sound. And when I hear it, I can write. With this particular book, it's based on the story of my mother-in-law, who grew up in a Chicago orphanage during the 30s and the 40s. So the sound I was chasing was her sound. It was her voice, which I got down in early drafts, but it was the worst book I've ever written in my life. I got the voice, but no, the story was, it was awful. And I had a friend, Gretchen Moran Laskus, who is a historical novelist, and she read it for me, and basically she gave me all sorts of great advice, right? And then she passed it back, and she's like, don't show this to anybody else, ever, because no. And because it was that bad. It was really, really bad. And so I had to figure out, okay, what is going to be the sound of this book? And I tried first person. I aged the character all different ages. I tried third person. I tried omniscient. Nothing worked. And I realized what I wanted, because I wanted everything, is I wanted a first person narrator. I wanted that intimacy, but I also wanted the range that an omniscient narrator has. And I could only think about, like, it had to be a supernatural something, you know? So it had to be a kind of narrator who would know everything and yet also have her own story. And so when I settled on Pearl, when I realized it had to be narrated by somebody else, that's when I found the book and I could write it. But it took me from 2002 to 2017, I think. I can't remember when I handed it in. It was a very, very long time. It was like a whole teenager. You know, it took that long.
So for all these books, perhaps especially the historicals, but I'd say all of them, setting and these details are so hugely important. And I know that Cherie and Laura, you must have spent literally years doing research and immersing yourself in 1940s Japan and Chicago, respectively. I mean, the amount of pure, like, just perfectly small details that are perfect, I don't even know how to describe it, but, like, it's incredibly immersive, both books. And Brandy and Christine, world building exists for books set in our own backyard too. I mean, like, even if it's Poughkeepsie in 2020, that's a world and you brought it fully to life. So how do you decide when you're writing what to include, what to leave out? Like, how do you take all these millions of details and synthesize them without getting bogged down?
So I think with me, I mean, it starts off, you're just in a dorm room staring at a ceiling. So there's not, you know, a lot of setting there. But as she's sitting there, she's thinking back about what led her to this place that she is now. And also my character is a mushroom forager and makes art out of mushroom spore prints, which is you put the cap down on a piece of paper and the mushroom releases its spores in this cool like bicycle spokes pattern. So there was like the dorm room where she's literally like just figuring, how am I going to get out of this bed? But then in her mind, she's like, okay, here's all the stuff that I'm thinking about while I'm avoiding getting out of this bed. So we go into the woods here in Poughkeepsie to look for mushrooms, go back to, you know, she was at a college party. She's a junior in high school, and her boyfriend has gone off to college at Marist College, which is here in Poughkeepsie. And so she's there on campus in the dorm. But thinking about, you know, what their relationship was like in the past and how things, actually this is her ex-boyfriend now, so things that have happened that have led her to make some not great choices. So it was kind of like, you know, figuring out how to weave all that together was really hard for me, figuring out how to structure all that, the stuff that was happening in the now, and then bringing stuff in to explain the now. And that was probably one of the biggest challenges for me, trying to structure that without it feeling like it was like a big bunch of backstory, and then, you know, trying to weave it together so it wasn't just, here's a lump of, you know, all the dysfunctional things that are happening in her family that got her to here. So I feel like that was the biggest challenge for me.
Well, yeah. I mean, your book is like literally, I don't know, when you hear the quote about Michelangelo like chipping away at a piece of marble, everything that isn't the statue, like your book is so spare. There's no room for a bunch of backstory, but somehow you managed to get in all this story too. Like, I don't know.
That's actually, you know, a good analogy. And that's kind of how I feel like it, like the statue analogy, or like things kind of have to come through the mist to you. So you can see it, but you can't quite see it. And then you just kind of have to fumble your way through to get to what really matters for your character, I think.
Yeah, I approached mine like I wanted to illuminate Japan and mm-hmm. and Japanese culture and Japan in World War II. So I followed my own curiosity on some things. And I wrote a sort of a quick and dirty draft of what I knew the story was going to be about, so that I know that what I didn't know. And then I went to Japan because I only had like a small window of time and a small amount of money to do actual in-person research. So I did a lot of book research, diaries, wartime diaries. Most Japanese kept diaries during the war. School kids had to keep diaries during the war. And I basically wrote the best version of it I could, and then made a list of all the things that were missing, and then went to this little town where the story is set, Chiron in southern Japan. And my guide, we stopped everybody who seemed to be of an age to have been around during the war. And I was just like, what did you eat? And what was this like? And what mm-hmm. about that? And some of them were like, please go away. And others were like, it's so strange that this Black American woman is asking us these questions. And they were sort of delighted by it. And some people were really excited, you know, it was interesting. But, and then, you know, you put it in there where it seems to make sense. And then you send it to, you know, I sent it to my editor, and she was like, well, I still don't understand why, like, why did we go to war? And I'm like, that's for diplomats and presidents, not for me, but okay. And then I go into more research and try to layer it in a way that, because ultimately, like, I know I'm omniscient, right? I know everything. I have hindsight, but now I have to put it through the point of view of a 15-year-old girl mm-hmm. in a small country town who doesn't know Jack, you know, and a boy who, like, what is propaganda telling you versus what do we know now? So that mm-hmm. was really that, but that helped weed out a lot of stuff or shape it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. Like, what could the character know?
And then trying to convince your editor or the readers that, like, no, I can't say that because, you know, like, people in this town didn't know Hiroshima had been bombed. Like, mm-hmm. there are parts of Japan that they heard there was a terrible bomb, but didn't really know the scope of it for a very mm-hmm. long time. People didn't know the war was over. So, you know, how do you make that clear without making it seem like you're being coy or naive? You know, that's always a trick.
I struggled with the same issues, and I didn't have the added cost of having to go to another country because I'm in Chicago. So I could do a lot of research here, but definitely, you know, the ensuing years, I spent a lot of time reading a lot of books, and a lot of diaries and a lot of letters, wartime letters. But I did a lot of interviews, and I did a lot of interviews with my mother-in-law, and then all of my husband's relatives, aunts and uncles, and then also other orphans who lived in the orphanage. I read through transcripts of girls who worked in the meatpacking district in the 30s to try to get the lingo. I mean, I did a lot of that kind of stuff. But it was also, I dealt also with, a main character who was institutionalized from age 3 to age 17, and she just didn't know. She didn't know why they were fighting in World War II. She didn't know why she was left at the orphanage. There was a million things she didn't know. And part of my choice to have somebody else or another character narrate this book was because of all the things that she didn't know. Like, I realized, like, I needed more elbow room than I could even get, just even manipulating point of view. It just wasn't going to work because she knew too little. But I always think that, and maybe Brandy wants to elaborate on this, but I always think that, when it comes to setting details, point of view is almost everything. It's like you're putting in what your characters would notice, right? What they would remark on, and skipping over sometimes what they wouldn't remark on, what they wouldn't notice, and which does make things challenging, I think, especially if you are dealing with a maybe first person or a closer third where, their world is entirely familiar and they wouldn't make any comment on it. So how are you going to convey this information to the reader? So,
yeah, I love details. I'm a super perceptive person. Like, mm-hmm. anyone who knows me is like, Brady doesn't miss anything. Like, I don't miss mm-hmm. anything. I want to know like what everybody's doing all the time. I want to know what they're eating. What time do they go to bed? What kind of, like, I want to know all of that. And I want to get that into my books to make my characters as real as possible. So for this book, it was kind of a challenge because I had originally, I'm curious if anyone who has read it would notice this and who's familiar with the area, but originally the town that they're in is set in Orange County in my mind. And I had it very specifically on the page because to me, Orange County is really interesting. So it's, this like kind of red enclave in this big blue state, which there are several pockets of red in California. But so I really wanted to play with that, but my editor was kind of like, no, let's just leave it more general to be a little bit more accessible. And to, quite honestly, from a craft point of view, just like have less rules to have to sort of conform to when it comes to elections and voting. So it's kind of set in this non-specific town, which was like, not super fun for me at first, thinking like, oh, I have to, I've written fictional towns before, but I really wanted it to be specific for this. But, once I sort of came to terms with that, I was able to say, well, it's still, I'm a fiction writer, I can still put all my own details into it. So I was able to make it, to me, as specific as possible with it still being, was that me? Did everyone else hear that chime?
Yes.
Okay. I think that anyway. Was my phone.
Oh, okay.
That's chiming.
Official. It was like a Zoom telling me to.
I'm going to bury it.
You're fine. So it was like fun to have those details and sort of apply them, to this place that for me at first felt like it was going to be a little bland, but then I could just, expand it and make like, the coffee shop they go to all the time or, this band where they perform at this like all ages club and things like that. So that was still fun to be able to play with.
For what it's worth, I definitely felt like it was set in Southern California.
Yeah, I figured you would. Like a native.
Yeah. I was like, maybe not like Huntington Beach, but like
a it little bit. It actually was. Yeah. It was like a fake Huntington Beach. Yeah.
There you go.
The beach. The beach they go to is like Huntington.
Mission
yeah. So yes. Thank you for noticing.
Okay. So how English teachers, you guys are all teachers too, but high school English teachers are always like, what's the metaphor or the symbol or like, what does the green light mean in The Great Gatsby? And this is probably betraying what a nut deep thinker I am, but when I was a kid, I was always like, what if he just likes the color green? Like, maybe it doesn't mean anything and you're just making shit up, is what I said. So let me ask all of you brilliant writers, do you purposely plant symbols and metaphors in your writing? Or are you just telling a story and sometimes there are symbols and metaphors that you don't even know and people are seeing them, but you didn't even know they were there to begin with? And perhaps a corollary to that is, are there themes or questions that you find yourself returning to again and again in the writing?
I mean, like, theme is my jam. Like, I'm kind of the opposite of you. I love theme, and so I can get too carried away with, like, taking this analogy. But so this girl who loves mushrooms, right, and looking for mushrooms. And the cool thing about mushrooms is you see a tiny, tiny fraction of the organism on the surface, and there's so much, like, underneath that you are walking around on that you don't even know about. And so I feel like that is like a big overarching theme of this book, that there's so much that's like kind of on the surface that she's just trying to go about her life and like push this all away and ignore it. But all the stuff underneath is, you know, like she is at a point after this party and while she's lying there that she has to deal with all this stuff. And also the fact that, mushrooms like are decomposers and they take things that are bad and make them good again. And so there are so many, like, there were so many poems that I threw out that were like more mushroom theme. Here's a question. Like, you know, I had to make it, you know, content. Like, we also had to talk about, you know, relationships and like, you know, teen parties and stuff. But I could have written an entire book with just like, here's this cool mushroom analogy. So I have to pull myself back from that, I think.
Cool.
I would say that, I mean, it's kind of for both. Like, there's tons of stuff that I'm interested in that I put in the books, and some of it's, you know, definitely thematic. I mean, doors, wolves, ghosts. I mean, and, you know, I would say that, I mean, the wolf at the door is something that I return to again and again, which is not necessarily meaning that I write about wolves behind doors or whatever. But what I mean is that I often write about girls who are punished for their appetites. I return to that all the time. You know, it's, oh, you know, it's the girls are too loud, or they misbehave, or they are hungry because they like to eat, or they like to laugh, or they want to have sex, or they want to do, you know, they're too for the world, and the world wants to contain them. So I go back to that. But there are definitely things that end up in books that I get asked about later. It's like, did you do this on purpose, Rob? I can't even think of one right now. That, you know, either my unconscious put in there, or just something that I thought was cool, like, you said, Jennifer, just like, you know, my character liked the color green, and that's why she's wearing a green dress. I don't know. I thought it was a good idea. It's fine. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. Both. Like, there are things that are intentional and things that are just hopefully happy accidents.
I think happy accidents is a good way of going. I think, for me, I feel like there's the stuff you do deliberately, like the blossom and firefly. The title came because kamikaze pilots were often referred to as fireflies because they live brief, bright lives, and obviously they fly. And then all of the female students in Japan were mobilized in units named after flowers. So my main character is a Nachiko Tai, and Nachiko is both the flower, and it is the word for the Japanese feminine ideal. And then for her name, I chose Hana because it also means flower, but it's an easy name for Western English speakers to grasp. So those things are there. So then there will be flower and blossom references throughout, and some firefly stories. But then, like, when you talk about recurring themes that you come back to, I heard once that writers, it's like your characters are an acting troupe, and it's the same actors playing different roles, but it's like you kind of, you're placing the same themes in each of your stories and acting them out in different costumes and different settings. And so I always come back to family and identity. And so this, as much as it's a love story between these two young people who you have to wonder if they will have a chance to figure out who they will be, because there is societal obligation, there is the real possibility of death. There's also, this is a love story between parents and children, absent fathers because of the war or emotionally absent, and mothers who have to learn to let them grow up and let go when that can mean something really awful. So that's my, again and again, I kind of hit those themes.
I just want to chime in real quick before Brandy answers, because what Laura and Cherie said, like writing kind of the same book over and over again, even though the trappings are different. I mean, to the point where sometimes you don't realize it. Like when I was thinking of titles for my book, I thought, because we're talking mushrooms also, there's like toxicity issues. So I'm like, ooh, toxic would be a great name. And I told my editor, and then I'm like, oh, wait, I have a book called Poisoned Apples. I don't think I can have a book called Toxic. And it's like ostensibly different things, like mushroom, mushroom book.
You have a series of
I didn't even, I think at one point I even thought of a title with poisoned in it, not remembering that like my other book also had poison in the title. It's like, how did I not think of that? Okay, sorry.
Brandy?
I feel like I just, like, people tell me things about my books afterward, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I totally did that. Like, I'm sure Tina's cracking up right now, our agent, because constantly I'll be like, this book is, the voting booth is probably, like, my most literal book. I mean, they just literally are going to this voting booth and voting. But I'm thinking of my other book that came out this year, which, you know, I have it here, so I'm going to be good at marketing and just say it's The Only Black Girls in Town. It's my first middle grade that also came out this year. But the title is very literal in that it's about these two girls who are pretty much the only black girls their age in their town. But then it also, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't read it, it also applies in a big part to like the subplot of the book. And I didn't realize this until like months after it was out. I was like, oh, wow, I did that. So I would say that my career has typically been just a series of happy accidents, if you ever see any theme in there. But I think it is working on some subconscious part of my brain that I don't understand. And as for theme, the themes that keep recurring in my work, it's family, like Cherie said, and secrets is something that I really keep coming back to. So again, I wouldn't say that necessarily really presents itself in this book, but really in most of my other, the family definitely is a big part of it. But secrets has been something that I've just really been exploring since my first book, and I have no plans to stop. So...
So let's talk pandemic for a minute. We're all living through this weird time. I know for me anyway, it's been incredibly difficult to concentrate and get any reading done, let alone writing. How are you all pushing through this? And do you have advice for writers who may be feeling like they're in a deep creative rut at the moment?
I mean, my advice is just not to put pressure on yourself. I kind of started off way back, you know, 1,000 years ago in April saying, hey, I'm going to do a NaNoWriMo for April. I'm going to, you know, just bang out this middle grade manuscript idea that I've had. And I started and it just went poof. I don't know. And then I realized like there's things that are more important for me to think about now, you know, like family, like it was great having my family all together. Just, you know, I think basically with writing, pandemic or no pandemic, like be kind to yourself is probably the advice that has helped me the most, because it's not easy for me to be kind to myself. So I've kind of taken this time like to step away from writing for a while and think about, oh, there are other parts of my personality and other things that I care about that I can focus on now, and the writing will probably come back later, but it's not here right now for me.
I agree with that. I think my problem is I have like 700 deadlines, including one that's coming up really, you know, soon, and I have to get it done or I don't get paid, and you know, that's a problem. So I've been really struggling with that. Like how, you know, this is my work. Like how do I get this done when, you know, my brain wants to go everywhere else? So I've been sort of I do agree you should be kind to yourself. So I have been better about just like, you know, if I don't write and like not beating myself up about it. I'm not a person who writes every day anyway. I don't really have any rules about writing, but you know, if the work's not getting done, that's an issue. So I try to just sort of immerse myself into more other creative things that I enjoy or that I find inspiring. Luckily, I have not been having trouble reading most of the time. So reading really good books has helped, you know, watching the zillions of TV and movies that we have available to us now, yoga, cooking, baking, talking to other writers. Is just all of that has been really kind of helpful. And I don't know, I feel like I sort of turned a corner. I don't know if it's because my deadline is coming up very soon. But you know, a couple of weeks ago where I was finally able to just start writing again and really feel like I was in it, not necessarily as much as I have been before. But I think just even forcing myself to just do it for a little bit every day has helped for me. So
yeah, I would, I'm sorry.
Okay, please, Laura.
No. You go.
Oh, mine is a very weird confession. But when I was a kid, and my mom would feed us something that I really didn't like, because there was this thing she'd forget what I liked, and like be like, "You love this," and I'd be like, "That's the wrong child," and I didn't want to eat it. This idea, but like you had to eat it, and my family had this rule of you had to take a Scout's bite, and so I had this idea that I wasn't really eating it. If I just left it in my mouth long enough, it would somehow dissolve and then I wouldn't have to actually like chew it and taste it, which is dumb, right? Because it's just sitting there on your tongue and you're tasting it. But so I sort of am doing that with like, I have multiple projects, multiple deadlines. And so before I go to bed, I'll take a bite of one of them, which is to say, I will look at it and go, what's needed next? And then I won't chew. I won't do anything. I'll just go to bed and I'll wake up in the morning. And sometimes it has become, you know, like I've absorbed it and now I can address it. I can go and write a little bit and move it a little bit further. So when I don't feel like writing or when it's just not sort of happening, I will try to prepare myself for writing, if that makes sense.
No, that totally does. I mean, I was going to say something similar, not about the chewing or not.
Yeah,
chewing.
That's just me. That's good for you. You're healthier than me.
Yeah.
It's not an eating disorder. It's just like a weird...
Now I'm having flashbacks to my mom forcing me to eat beets, which I hated. Anyway, and I still hate. So I've struggled... I was supposed to be working on a certain YA and I had this idea that I was going to be working on a particular project. And then the pandemic hit and I realized like, I just could not do that project. I did not have the emotional connection to it that I needed. You know, like I wasn't there. It was, the emotional line of the main character, what in that other project was, you know, a girl, who's kind of, sort of becoming more fully embodied, like in her own physicality and feeling her own power. And I have not been feeling my own power. I've been feeling really rageful, you know, but that's not the same thing. And I couldn't access that book. So I found myself working on something else. I switched. And what I've needed to do is actually break the book down into much smaller chunks than normal. In that, you know, I wake up in the morning and before, this is if I'm being very diligent, I don't look at email, I don't look at social media, because otherwise I'm going to be a lunatic and I'm screaming and nuts and yelling at cats, Milo, do something about the post office. you know, I mean, just because it makes me so crazy. But if I don't look at anything, I can write a certain amount of words per day. And I think what's good is to come up with like a doable thing. And for me, doable is 1,000 words. I could do 1,000 words in the morning. And sometimes they were hard and took me a while. And sometimes they were easy, just sort of depending. But I could generally do that in a reasonable pace. But I don't know, whatever breaks you can give yourself. I tweeted recently, we're all going to need a gap year, because I really think we're all going to need a gap year, because I don't like I don't know what's going. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know even what I just finished a draft and I just handed it to Tina, my agent, and I don't know what I wrote. I don't know if it works.
I recommend that we just sort of hold 2020 in our mouths and hope it dissolves.
Yes. Yes, I think that's a good. I don't know if I want to hold it in my mouth though.
No. Your mother lets you spit it out because it gets.
Yes. Gross. Spit it out.
Kind of, I mean, I know that none of us are mind readers or know how any thing of this insane year is going to play out, but do you think that authors of contemporary fiction are going to have to acknowledge 2020? Like, how is this going to shape narratives? Or are we just going to skip it? And be like,
I'm really
what?
Struggling with that. Because I'm working on something that's contemporary. And I wanted it to be, it was like, oh, this is set in sort of like a Trump presidency, which was appropriate. And then I was like, oh, well, with the election coming up, that might be different. And then someone was like, you know, if he doesn't win this time, he could always run next time. And then I was like, okay, so now I'm writing 8 years in the future. And then, like, this happened. And I'm like, okay, so now I'm writing in a COVID-22 world where, you know, and so it's become speculative as a result. And I'm wondering, and it actually freed me up because it allowed me to think of solutions for now. Like, what will the world look like to make it livable? And, you know, that was actually really useful for me. And then it was neat to see that maybe it was popping up in the news. So my job's done, and now I'm going to go back to writing contemporary.
I've seen people talking about that online, and someone was like, you know, I'll never be able to write anything, you know, in the future without addressing the pandemic. But I feel... I mean, as someone who wrote a book about voting and we don't even know who's running in the election, like, clearly I make my own rules in my fiction. And I just think, like, I don't have to address it if I don't want to. We don't even know what it's going to look like in 6 months, let alone, you know, by the time my next book's come out. So for me, I'm just writing for the story. If I happen to think of something that revolves around it or even where it's appropriate to address it. But I just feel like we just don't know. And it's fiction. So we can, I just wonder if writers in 1918, you know, in the years after the flu pandemic of that time, if they were thinking about this, like, I don't remember seeing a bunch of, I could have missed all of it, but I don't remember seeing like a bunch of literature that addressed that pandemic. So I don't know. I'm just, for me, I just think we can do what we want, but I am interested to see what other people will do if they do address it in their fiction.
I don't think so. I mean, I do think that, like, probably what happened is everybody in 1920 or whenever after the pandemic was over and after World War I was over, they probably thought, well, F it. Now we're all flappers. Jazz age, baby. Let's forget everything.
I read something that said that there wasn't a lot of writing about the pandemic. Like, people just kind of wanted to forget about it and moved on. So going back to look at the history of it, there wasn't this a big, you know, soul searching or putting it in every book. So
fair enough.
Maybe that's like weird. Like,
conversely, I've read that there was, like, during the plague, like the Black Plague, that there were references to plague in things that we still read today, but we don't understand the references anymore because they were using the code at the time. Okay. So,
I mean, on a plot scale, it's kind of that thing where, you know, when you're writing contemporary realistic fiction, it's like, I have to have the current technology, I have to have the current, you know, slang, I have all this stuff, and you can just drive yourself crazy trying to be in au courant, and then everything changes like the next week. So if you think too hard about it, I think it can definitely impede your process.
So from our audience, Phoebe asks Chris and also the other authors, if you want to speak to this, there is, as we know, a lot of pressure for authors sometimes to publish quickly. But we all know how that sometimes works out. And I know that some of you are more slow writers. Do you have wisdom or advice for writers who are on the slow path?
Well, I guess it depends, you know, like, if writing is something that you're using, you know, to pay your bills, and if that's your main source of income, it's hard to be on the slow path. And I've kind of been reckoning with that lately. You know, I really can't produce something until I feel like my heart is in it. So taking such a long time for this book was a teeny bit of an agonizing process. And so I've been looking about how to not, you know, like other things that I do, perhaps I can use to get income and then not put that kind of pressure on my writing. So I think it depends on where, you know, you are in your career. If this is where, you know, like Brandy has all these deadlines and she can't afford to just go out and, you know, stare at the sky and watch the leaves. And I am trying to like,
wish I could. Yeah. I can, you know, but.
Yeah. So it depends, I guess, on, you know, whether you have a contract that's like the albatross on your back or whether you can be like, oh, I'm contract free now and I can just kind of explore what I want to do and see what happens.
I would also add, I think, you know, and I mean, because there are certain projects that I write, I always have a bunch going. So when one isn't working, so when I said, okay, like 13 Doorways took from 2002 to 2000 and whatever, 17, whatever, that wasn't the only project I was working on. So I juggle. And you know, sometimes you really don't know how to fix. You have a draft, you don't know how to fix it, you don't know where it's going. I'm not a person who thinks that projects are dead. There are projects that I don't know how to fix yet, that I don't know how to make work, and I just put them aside until I figure it out. And it could be, I don't know, decades, and I don't really care, because I can move on to the next one. So if you can get used to juggling, you know, maybe not within the same day or even in the same week, but you know, month to month, maybe, I don't know, that could give you it might speed up the process, because really when you're working on one project, your mind is solving problems for the other one, you know, and you're getting ideas for the other one. So that's kind of worked for me.
I have a combination of work for hire. So like I'm writing mm-hmm. nonfiction books that are part of a series. And so nonfiction, my brain works differently in that it's a different process. And I write comic books, and that's sort of writing from a different corner of my writing brain too. And that definitely helps. But I think it was Rebecca Stead, who, you know, is an amazing author, mm-hmm. became an agent because she said she's too slow as a writer, but she loves books. So she wanted a day job that allowed her to still be in it and let her take her time on the books that she wants to write. And I think that that's brilliant if you can find the right, you know, the right day job to keep you happy, you know, and keep you fed, because somebody's got to pay the bills.
Well, I mean, as an agent, I wouldn't say that that's a quick fix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. But you know, like, I mean, we're all, you know, in a literary life is pieced together, you know. This is the original gig economy, I think, you know, like and you write, and you write for hire, and you speak, and you do songs and dances and hope that it keeps afloat.
And I would also say, like, I'm not a slow writer, partially because you know, the majority of my income is based on my books, but also, like, I don't know, I just think, like, if you are a slow writer, just try to embrace it, you know, because I'm a fast writer, I always have been. I've been writing since I was a kid, and I just have, like, literal, like, piles of notebooks of my writing as a kid, so I've always been this way, but I don't know, like, sometimes I'm, like, look back at my books, and I'm like, wow, it would have been nice to have spent a little more time with that. I think we all, no matter how fast or how quick we write, kind of look back and think, oh, I would change that, or like, you know, what's up with that chapter or that character for that matter. But you know, I would have loved to have had some more time with some of my books, you know, even if there wasn't a contract, just like to sit there with them a little longer and think about them a little longer. So, you know, if you can afford to, and if, you know, it doesn't feel like it's too burdensome, you know, just maybe try to embrace it a little bit too.
Awesome. So I think, Leif, do we have time for one more question?
Yeah, we could definitely do one more if anyone has.
Okay. So my question is, can you tell us what you're working on now? What's next for you? Or if you don't want to tell us that, what else you're excited about? Or what you're obsessed with? I'm obsessed with grapes. Anything.
I think right now, you know, I am taking a little break from writing, and I think that paradoxically is going to help me write faster because I'm doing manuscript critiques. I'm doing some other work. I'm thinking about going to grad school for ESL teaching. And the good thing about writing is, right, you can do it in the cracks and crevices. So I think sometimes when I have giant spans of hours to do it, I get, you know, as much done or less done when I have like 2 hours to be like, okay, I have to get this done now. So I'm kind of, you know, this book was such a journey for me that I'm trying to step back for a little bit, and I think that's going to help in the long run, my writing, and yeah.
I have, it feels weird to say I'm excited about it, it's a really harrowing subject matter, but my next book is a nonfiction book about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, so that will be written for younger readers. I'm not sure, I'm writing it right now, I'm not sure if it's YA or middle grade, I'm going to guess it's going to be sort of appropriate for all. But yeah, so I'm working on that. And then I have some other stuff that will hopefully be able to be announced soonish.
Intriguing. Sheree?
I was going to concede to Laura. I'm working on my no longer contemporary, possibly dystopian story. That's a young adult novel. I just finished one of my little nonfictions, What is the Civil Rights Movement, with Brandy Colbert as my copy editor on that.
So yeah, it's a great book.
Thank you, Brandy. And I am excited about your Tulsa book. So I think that was the right book for it. What was the Harlem Renaissance? So I'm gearing up now on another Who HQ, that's what that series is, another one of those books. And I'm working on a graphic novel that I can't say anything about yet other than I'm working on a graphic novel. And I got another comic book series that sort of lodged in the pipes of COVID that is an Ursula Little Mermaid villains a three-issue arc that's supposed to come out when the world opens up again. So I'll see you guys in 10 years.
Tantalizing. Thank you. Laura?
I have a bunch of things in the works. I just handed in a YA manuscript, like I mentioned earlier, that I would say is a love story, I think. I don't know. I'll figure it out. I'm not sure what it is. There are lots of bugs in it. That's all I'm going to say. I have a fascination.
Wait, do you mean glitches or actual creatures?
Actual bugs, because I've had a fascination with bugs since I was a kid. I don't know. Whatever. Will that work? I'm not sure. But lately, I've been sort of obsessed with poetry. I'm in an MFA program right now studying poetry, so I'm writing a lot more poetry, which is kind of helping me with the whole COVID weirdness, I think. You know, sometimes I have to think small in order to produce anything. So I would say that. And other fascinations include home decorating. So I have been basically just spending all of my time obsessively buying throw pillows, light fixtures, various area rugs, new towels, things like that, because this is all I see. I don't leave my house. I would get more cats. But my husband has a kind of a cat ceiling. So, so it's area rugs. That's what's happening.
Amazing. So Christine, yeah. Your friends have created a special surprise for you.
Oh.
So we're going to play it. But first, I want to thank everyone for coming. Thank you for helping us celebrate the Hudson Valley YA Society's 10th anniversary. Stick around if you want to see Christine's special surprise. But if I don't see you again, mwah, we love you and thanks for coming.
Thank you so much to Laura Ruby, Sheree L. Smith, Brandy Colbert, and Christine Hepperman for letting me record this panel for the podcast, and for the gift of their wonderful books. and to Oblong Books and Music for hosting the event. As always, all the books we chatted about here will be up on my website, jenniferlofren.com/literaticast. And there are some signed books still available to order through oblongbooks.com. The links to that will also be on my website. The Literaticast has a Patreon. That's patreon.com/literaticat. Throw in a buck and you help me keep the show coming. I also always appreciate reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. More reviews help folks find the show. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.